Accession number 10295, reel 3.
Mr. Lynn, reel 3.
Yep. As I was saying, he was talking to him in English, and these were raw Arabs, uneducated Arabs, so they couldn't understand a word of what he was saying. And his idea was he was taking them to the gates, and he was telling them that they had to go back to their friends and tell them what they were up against. Explain to them about all this ammunition and all these guns that we'd got and the way we were better equipped to deal with them, you know. And he was actually on the point of letting them go through the gate when the duty officer came down and spotted what was going on. And of course, he interfered and sent them, put the rebels back in the tents again. And give Dizzy a good turn off. But he was never charged with anything. As I say, he was, everybody knew he was not mental. It wasn't mental. It's a wrong thing to say about a man that's given everything, you know. So what happened then was that the arrangements were with the Palestine police that any men that we picked up, any rebels, we had to phone the Palestine police up. And they would come and take them into Acre prison. We couldn't do that. It had to be a police job. But they always, I think they did it, what, with their tongue in their teeth. They didn't really want any prisoners. You know, all they wanted was to be told, there's so many dead men, come and collect them, which they did. So taking live ones was a bit of a bloody nuisance, because it meant they had to stand trial. The policeman would have to go and give his evidence. We would have to go and give our evidence, you know. So on this particular day, the seven rebels were told that they were going into Acre to stand trial. But it was explained to them that you've got another chance, and that is we can kill you now or send you for trial. But if you agree to what we say, if you agree to do what we tell you, you can go for trial, which, and you have every chance of getting away with it. Other than that, we'll just bloody shoot you out of hand. So, of course, the rebels said, whatever you say, we'd rather go for trial. So they took him round the back. And any lads who were doing nothing at the time, they were all to, we all gathered round, and they stood and formed a, what? They formed two lines of men. Some with pickaxes, like pickaxe halves. Some with bayonet scabbards, you know, with a bayonet inside. Some with the rifles. Whatever was there, tent mallets, tent pegs. And the rebels were sent one at a time through this, what do you call it, gauntlet. And they were belted and bashed until they got to the other end. Now, any that could run when they got to the other end, run straight into the police meat wagon, and they were sent down to Acre. Any that died, they went into the other meat wagon, and they were dumped at one of the villages on the outside. Now, when we got them, when they was taken to Acre, they, usually the trial lasted 2 days, a day, for all of them. And then they were hung. It was a public hanging. There was no, nothing quiet about it or anything like that. And I've got pictures of them there.
Did you attend the hanging?
No, no. We weren't allowed to attend them. Some of the lads did, but they weren't supposed to be. So the pictures are taken from off the hills. The market, I think it was a marketplace attacker. It was a big square anyway. And round it there was three or four scaffolds. And what they did was take the rebel over, tie him up, and that was it. And he was hung there, left hanging there. And then his relatives or whoever came and cut him down. Usually it was one of the, what do you call them, the Arab priests?
Mullahs.
The mullahs, yeah. One of them would come and cut him down, take him away. Another trick we used to, do, the lads, was we had petrol for the 1,500 weights. They were in either 4 or 5 gallon plums, I think it was 4 gallon cans. And the sides were, they had the arrow on them, you know, the government arrow. Well, Anderson was my mate. We'd been together all the way through, thick and thin, all straight through the life. And he and one or two of the others, drivers, had come across a scheme whereby they could go out and go to the one of the villages and flog four-gallon plimsies of petrol. And they'd probably sell it for about 50, 60, possibly 100 piastres. You know, which to them it was drinking money. So they'd go down to the village in a 1500 weight. Some excuse or another, they'd go out the gates with a 1500 weight. And nobody would bother. They'd assume we'd got a pass, you know, so they'd go out. And they'd plug 4 gallons of this petrol. And then he would drive back, but at the same time, he'd call the Palestine police and tell them that he'd spotted some petrol in a certain village. So then the Palestine police would phone our camp up and ask for someone to meet him at the village. And one of the other guys would then go out in a truck, go to this village, they'd find the guy who bought it, and he'd be taken to prison, you know, taken for trial. And the 4 gallons would, 4 cans would then be put back on our truck and we'd bring it back. And then 4 gallons and poor 4 gallon cans must have travelled for bloody miles and miles in Palestine, because they never ever got opened, you know. And that was a way of making drinking money. There were various other ways, but we didn't get as bad as some of the lads. I believe one of them, one of the other regiments, was plugging rifles and ammunition and, in one case, a machine gun.
So the rebels?
Mm. Yeah. See, ammunition in those days, rifles and ammunition, was a thing that was very important, and it was very, very bad, really, for us. If you're fighting a skirmish in Palestine in those days, you was issued with a bandolier of 25 rounds. When you got back off your, you know, your duty, skirmish, whatever, you handed those 25 rounds in, and there had to be 25 rounds there. And if there was a round of ammunition missing, then you was on a charge if you couldn't say where it had gone. But if you could produce the empty cartridge that you'd fired that, during that bullet, then you was only fined 6 pence. If the whole bullet was missing, it was 2 and 6. By the same rule, if you found a revolver, you got 2 and 6. I think it was 2 and 6 or 5 bob, I'm not sure. If you found a rifle, you got 10 bob. So every rebel that you killed, you got paid for the whatever you took off him, his ammunition. In our case, the four of us that shot this man, it was a German, by the way, the one we shot out the tree. It was a German mercenary. And he was using a Moser. You know the Moser that has a butt that you can fit on it. You can use it as a pistol or fit a butt on it. It was one of those. We got 10 bob between us for that.
How did you know he was a German, though?
His papers running. And, as I say, we used to get so much for each bullet or each rifle or anything we brought back. But the thing was that you can be under fire and, you're firing away and suddenly you've got to change position and go over there or over here. You can't take your bloody empty cases with you, but you have to. You have to bend down and grab your empty case and stuff them in your pocket. And you know yourself that when you're firing a 303, you come back, slam the bolt back, the shell case goes over there, can go over anywhere. And if you didn't hand your shell case in when you got back, you was fined. If you hand the bullet in, or if you didn't have a bullet, then you was fined. You had to have a shell case, or else you was on a charge. And you had to prove then where the thing had gone. They told us that the reason for that was so that the rebels couldn't get the cases and use them again, which to me was a load of bull. You know, if they got the money and the initiative to get where they were, they didn't need our empty shell cases. But that was the thinking in those days. So, anyway.
Why do you think that the officers couldn't put a stop to these rackets?
They were in the rackets. Oh, the officers, if they weren't in them, they just couldn't care less anyway. They were below an officer, he's got a fighting machine and he's got to control it. You know, so you've got to give it a little bit of leeway, otherwise it'll turn on you. You know, it's just like a guard dog. You can keep it under control, but if you give it a bit of leeway, it'll turn on you. If you give it a bit of extra rope, I should say, then it'll turn on you, these men. But as I was saying about the rifles and, you know, bullets and stuff like this, it was a fallacy and I couldn't understand it, that you had to carry these things with you. You had to bring your empties back, and to me it was daft.
What did the other regiments think about regiments that sold ammunition to the rebels?
Well, we never met one another. We never, ever, while we was in Palestine, same as in Egypt, we fought boxing matches together, we played football against one another, and this, that and the other. But in Palestine, no, it was a big area. It's a big area to cover. So we had very little to do with other units. We only heard about it.
But when you heard about it, weren't you bitter about it?
Well, no, not really. It was nothing to do with us. It wasn't us that was flogging him. You know, if the lad thought he was, you know, if it was not on his conscience, it wasn't certainly on ours.
But you might have been the casualty from one of the bullets that they'd stopped.
Yeah, but you wouldn't know, would you? And in any case, any bullet that kills you, it doesn't matter who it comes from, it kills you. You know, no, I think most of the lads, they thought it was a rotten thing, it was a dirty trick. But they didn't hold any brief. They all more a brief of other things. I mean, there was a guard duty in the Elizabethan Hotel. It was three men and a lance corporal, and it was the same as any ordinary peacetime guard mounting, except that you carried live ammunition. But instead of having a bandolier, each guardsman was given, or each centre was given, five rounds. So at the end of the day, or in the morning when they changed guard, the officer in charge, or duty sergeant, or whoever, came down and examined the guard and watched them change. And then he would inspect the ongoing guard and the one that's coming off. Now, the system was that the guard that was going off would hand over to the new guard, and they would go away. When the guard that was going off would then be told to clear the magazine. Well, most of them had already cleared it. The last man on would still have one in his up the spout. So he told to clear magazine. And to do this, what you do, you slam your catch, your safety catch, your cover on top of the magazine to prevent any further rounds coming up. Then you rattle your bolt three times, click it and fire it. Because having cut off the bullets, there should be nothing up there other than that one, which you flicked out. So on this particular morning, the guard commander was a fellow called Penny, Lance Corporal Penny. And it was raining, so they'd done the guard change inside the Elizabethan Hotel, in the foyer. And he told them to clear rifles for inspection and all this and the other. And the lad at the end of it, his name was Steve Allen. He was a young lad, blonde-haired kid. And he'd been the last on. So they was told to cut off, you know, to close the cut off, rattle the bolts, and then fire. And they'd all done it immaculate, same as they were trained to do. But as Steve Allen fired, and the bullet went up in the air, ricocheted around the room, came down and hit to Lance Corporal Penny in the stomach and killed him. And there was an inquiry, and Alan got sent home, Steve Allen. He got 6 months in detention, then sent home. And that was the price of life, 6 months.
What did you feel about that?
That was caused more anger amongst the lads than selling the machine gun. Because that was a thing that should never have happened. He was supposed to be a soldier, a trained soldier, supposed to look after one another. But we wasn't looking after one another. And that was a thing that they couldn't forgive. They could forgive a man for, you know, flogging ammunition, flogging petrol, anything like that. But that kind of thing they couldn't. you had to be able to depend on your mates. If you couldn't, then what was the use, you know?
Coming back to that running the gauntlets business, did you feel sorry for the chaps who had to run the gauntlet?
At the time, no. No, don't forget, I was a young lad, I was only 18. I mean, now, thinking back on it, you know, it was a rotten thing to do, and I don't think I could do it again. I don't think I could even stand the sight of the blood now. But in those days, I don't know, he was a young warrior, and it was excitement, and he was, I don't know, You was supreme, you was in charge, you was in control, you had the power. And this is what it was all about, you know, being a soldier, you had the power to do things. And you did it.
But did you hate them for what they'd done?
Oh, no. Oh, no, there's no hatred in it. Oh, no, that is a thing that a lot of people can't understand about soldiering. Soldiers don't go into battle with any hate, you know, anything like that. They're going there because they've been trained to do a certain thing. Their job is to kill. I mean, a butcher's job is to chop meat up. A milkman, his job is to deliver milk. A soldier, his job is to kill. Or at least kill and try not to be killed himself. No, there was no hatred. No hatred at all. I mean, the only hatred was when you got one in your company. You knew that someone had been killed, one of your men had been killed. Then there was hatred. Because you didn't know whether it was him that had killed your mate. But apart from, you know, that type of thing, initially, there was no hatred there. It was only when they'd killed one of yours that you began to hate them.
You say a soldier's job is to kill, but once you've got your prisoners, then they can't do any harm in any case.
Yeah, but they're an encumbrance. They're an encumbrance. And on top of that, in these particular seven, we knew that their fellows, or even them themselves, had killed Jockey Harper, Curry, Fury. Mick Fury is another one that had been killed. We knew that if they hadn't killed him, their friends or brothers had to. So as far as we was concerned, they were rubbish, they were dead.
What did you think would happen if you fell into their hands?
Same thing. The same thing. None of our lads ever fell into their hands. None of the Manchester Regiment. But we did hear of others where they'd fallen into the Arabs. And what they did was just cut you to pieces. I can remember the names of all the lads that fell into their hands. Tibby Pierce, he was with the Manchesters in Egypt. He went on in front of us to Palestine and joined the Palestine police. He'd been in Palestine 2 months, 3 months. And he was in the middle of the street directing traffic, and an Arab just walked straight up to him, put his gun to the back of his head like that and blew his head off. Another instance was Greenhouse. He was... I think his name was Ernie Greenhouse or Jim Greenhouse, not sure. He was the battalion goalkeeper. And the battalion had been out and played football against a WOG team. And we beat them. And the lads had been out after the match, as usual, and gone and had a piss up, one thing or another. And Greenhouse was found the next day, was cut to pieces and on the railway line. I've got piece of photographs of him, just chopped up on the railway line and left there. Trains didn't run on that railway line. But he was all in pieces. That's when we got angry, things like that. But in actual battle, in actual skirmish, there was no hatred. It was pure, cold, calculated, take aim, fire.
No. Had Pierce and Greenhalgh been killed before you captured these rebels?
Oh, yes, yeah.
So yeah. There was that kind of background?
Oh, yes, but that had gone... You remember these things for we'll say, a month at the most. And then it's forgotten. Then you've got a clean sheet and you start again. It's just if you happen to be unfortunate to be a rebel that's caught within a certain time. You know, within, say, a week or a fortnight of an initial thing happening. After that, no, you just don't tie the two together. You're back to being a squaddy. You're back to doing this as you're told.
Were there any officers around when they were made to run the gauntlet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So it was done with approval?
I don't think I could name any names of them. I don't think I can name any names. Oh, yes, definitely done with their approval. One was what they call, if you ever talk to King Clark, he will tell you that he used to pull some real stunts with rebels. Him being in amongst them, you know, working and trading in with them. They thought he was a rebel, thought he was an Arab. And he could get information and pass it back. But he didn't pass it back to us. He used to pass it back to Wingate. because Wingate was, more or less the OC of Palestine at that time. And Wingate would then decree what type of action would be taken on this information.
Did you come across Wingate in Palestine?
Twice. One time he gave us a lecture and told us exactly what he thought of the rebel and what our job was. And then the second time was to give us a lecture that he'd formulated a new idea or a new drill, and it was called a flying patrol or a flying picket, he called it, and it worked wonders. It worked absolutely marvellous. And that was that a unit of, say, 20 men, 25 men, with 15 underweight trucks, fully equipped, bristling with equipment, would be on standby at all times at certain spots. So all you're using is 15 or 25 men, I should say. And they would be at given places. And as soon as there was a whisper of any kind of trouble, those men had to be on that action, in action, within 15 to 20 minutes. So there was always, one of these patrols within a certain distance. And an Arab only had to cough, and the patrol was there. Didn't give them a lesson. And it really brought it down to, spasmodic stuff. One of the spasmodics was, where the hell was it? I think it was Beersheba. It was just outside there somewhere, where we were sent out. We had to get out there quick. There was an uprising in this particular village. And we went to the village hellfire, We got there, but we couldn't get to the village in the trucks. The road was really rough, really bad, within the last few yards, So we all had to dismount and run in. And run into this village, 15, 20 establishments, maybe a bit more. And as we got in, there was no men. It was all women. And they were cursing us and shouting. I don't know what they were saying. But as the men run in, the women bared the breasts and started running at us. And what they wanted to do was to impale themselves on our bayonets for our marching to publicity, to create a bit of a stink against us.
To claim that you'd wounded their breasts?
Yeah. Say that we'd charged them with bayonets. So the officer in charge, he just shouted out, I think this was Griffiths or Griffin, I'm not sure. But he shouted to take the bayonets, take your bayonets off. So, put the bayonets back in the scabbards. And then he said, right, release your bayonets and do as I do. And he got a bayonet and he went to one of the women, slapped her on the arse. Of course, everybody started laughing, and the men then went round slapping arses, and the women didn't laugh for them. They weren't brave. They were brave enough to have a bayonet stuck in them, but it was an embarrassment to be slapped on the backsides. And, the situation was just cool like that. But the thing was that even that instance, any instances like that, we had radios, more times it was telephone. We got through to headquarters, and they would send the engineers in. And the engineers would just come in and put a torch to all the houses. Most of the houses were set on fire. If we thought they were causing trouble, then you'd set the house on fire. Blow it up, do whatever you could.
Just coming back to what you said about Wingate, what did he say in his lecture to you about what he thought about the rebels?
I can't remember him word for word, but he was telling us that although they weren't highly trained, they were dedicated men. And these men are dedicated to a cause just same as you are. That you have to look on them as fighting men. That they are something.
In other words, not to be contemptuous of them.
Oh, yeah. Always. Never be contemptuous of the enemy. That was his one cry. Never, ever underestimate your enemy. He's always considered he's one better than you, and you'll get by. No, he was he's a fantastic guy, I reckon, Wingate. I've only read about him since, you know. But thinking back to Palestine, I can realise now what type of man he was, what he was building up.
What kind of visual impression did he make on you when you saw him?
Oh, it was nothing. It was just another, as far as he was concerned, it was another red cap. You know, he's got a red bonnet on, a red hat on, and pips on his shoulders. As far as he was concerned, he was just another officer. And he was another fella telling us what to do.
Did he look like a normal officer?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was dressed in his usual KD, you know, with his putties on. In those days, we had putties. You know.
So he didn't look eccentric in any way?
He was never eccentric. No way. No. He was a man who thought very, very clearly, I thought. To do what he's done, to have done what he's done, you couldn't be an idiot. You couldn't be. You've got to be thinking, man. You know, I marvel at the way he formed the Jindits. I only wish that, instead of Singapore, I'd been with him in the Middle East. I think very little has been said about the man. He hasn't got the what do you call it?
Credit.
That's a little bit more than credit, I think. There's nothing he can do, even posthumously, you couldn't do anything about it. But he should have been, I say, he should have been in charge of Singapore. There's no doubt about that.
What other memories have you got about the Arab revolt in Palestine that you can tell me about?
Other than the ones, you know, personal ones, I'm still of the opinion that Palestine belongs to Palestinians. It's only a personal opinion, but people tell me I'm wrong. They say, oh, I'm bitter and all this, that and the other. I've got no reason to be bitter against the Jews. I've never ever met them, apart from being bitter about them hanging the sergeants in 1948. Apart from that, I've got no axe to grind. I used to go out with a young Jewish girl while I was in Palestine. But from my point of view, Palestine is for the Arabs. It's not Jewish. They've only gone in there because it's a wonderful country. It's a terrific climate. They can make a pot of money. You know, and that's all they're there for. I don't know. Do you do much reading on... have you read about the initial... Jews?
The what?
The initial Jews when they first...